Have you ever wondered if changing your mind could literally change the physical shape of your brain?
I mean, it's a wild thing to think about, right?
It really is. Like, if you were to look at the brain of someone who is dealing with severe, chronic depression under an electron
Yeah,
microscope,
the actual physical structure.
right, the physical architecture of their neural networks, it looks uncannily like a dying tree.
It's a really bleak image, actually.
Yeah, the branches, what neuroscientists call dendrites, right?
Yeah,
They're literally withering away.
exactly. The tiny connection points where one neuron talks to another are just disappearing.
And for a very long time, we thought this kind of structural degradation was, I mean, incredibly difficult to
Oh,
fix.
absolutely. If not entirely impossible to reverse quickly.
Right. But what if a single dose of a highly specific molecule could just, force that dying tree to sprout thousands of new healthy branches in just 24
It
hours?
sounds like science fiction.
Yeah.
Or maybe like a gross exaggeration of how biology even works.
Right. But it's not, is it?
No, it's really not. That rapid, explosive regrowth is precisely what modern neuroscience is capturing in real time right now. We're looking at a fundamental shift in our understanding of neuroplasticity here.
And that is exactly the mission of our deep dive today. We want to explore how certain molecules remodel the brain's architecture in real time. We're pulling from this fascinating, super detailed article from the OOTW Journal.
Yes, the piece is called Psychedelics, BDNF and Psychoplastogens, How the Brain Rewires.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because
Okay.
for anyone listening who follows neuroscience or even just modern psychiatry, I mean, this is the kind of research that makes you stop in your
It
tracks.
really does. It
Yeah.
validates a lot of excitement, but it also completely shifts the paradigm.
Exactly, because we are talking about going from the abstract, the felt experience of a chemical, to the concrete reality of cellular tissue completely remodeling itself.
Right, and to really grasp how wild this is, you have to look at the historical baggage of how we've talked about these molecules for the last 100 years.
So, for 100 years, the whole conversation around psychedelics, like whether it was indigenous use, or the counterculture in the 1960s, or even the early psychiatry
Yeah,
stuff.
figures like Humphrey Osmond.
Right, it was all completely phenomenological. It was described entirely by what these substances did to the subjective experience.
Exactly. People talked about visions or the feeling of the ego dissolving, accessing buried memories.
It was poetry, basically, philosophy.
Right. It was William James talking about varieties of religious experience. People weren't talking about cellular growth.
No, they were talking about meeting God. Or confronting demons.
And from a scientific standpoint, that created a massive bottleneck. Because, I mean, how do you quantify a dissolved ego?
You can't put a ruler to a mystical revelation.
You really can't. So for decades, psychiatry struggled with this. Patients would report these life-altering experiences, achieving remission from treatment-resistant depression or addiction, but the data was fuzzy.
It was just qualitative.
Right. And in the hard sciences, if you can't measure the physical mechanism, you often just get dismissed. So the paradigm shift we're discussing today is the transition from just listening to qualitative reports to actually pointing a microscope at the cerebral cortex.
And actually watching the physical counterpart to that subjective experience happen.
Exactly.
I was trying to map this onto something familiar for you, the listener, while I was reading the OOTW Journal piece. And I kept coming back to a computer analogy.
Oh, I like that. The software versus hardware idea.
Yeah, exactly. Like, for decades, we essentially treated these substances as a temporary software update.
Like booting up a weird avant-garde operating system.
Right, for like 6 to 8 hours, the interface gets super distorted, the colors are running together, maybe the filing system randomly opens these old hidden folders.
A very vivid, occasionally chaotic software run.
Exactly. But the assumption was always that once the program stops running, once the drug clears your system, the physical computer sitting on your desk is exactly the same machine it was yesterday.
The hardware hasn't changed.
Right. But this new structural biology research throws that completely out the window. It's not a software update. It's as if the computer case pops open and thousands of tiny robotic arms start soldering new physical wires onto the motherboard
In real time.
in real time. And by the time the software stops running, you are physically operating on a fundamentally upgraded machine.
What's fascinating here is that the hardware analogy perfectly captures the magnitude of this shift. Because if you only change the software, the machine's ultimate processing capacity hasn't changed.
Right, it's still stuck with the same physical wiring.
Exactly. But if you solder new connections onto the motherboard, you have fundamentally altered the processing power, the efficiency, the available pathways.
Wow.
And I think it's crucial to ground this in biology for everyone listening, like your habits, your chronic anxieties, the way you reflexively react to criticism.
They aren't just floating ethereal concepts.
No, they are physical, biological structures in your head, deeply entrenched neural highways. And what this research shows is that those physical highways are capable of rapidly reshaping themselves, building new off-ramps within hours.
Which is mind-blowing. But I really want to get into the actual proof here. Because if you're claiming that we can resolder the motherboard of the human brain, you need massive evidence.
You do. You can't just make that claim lightly.
So the article leans heavily on this landmark breakthrough from 2018 to prove this isn't just theoretical. It's the study from Calvin Lai, David Olson, and their team.
Yes, published in Cell Reports. That paper, Psychedelics Promote Structural and Functional Neuroplasticity, is really the absolute linchpin for this entire modern frontier.
So what did they actually do?
Well, what they did was brilliantly straightforward, but technically incredibly demanding. They took a range of classic psychedelics, so LSD, DMT, which is the active component in ayahuasca, and DOI, a synthetic psychedelic.
Okay, so a good mix of the heavy hitters.
Right. And they applied them directly to neurons to see what would happen on a strictly structural, microscopic level.
And the physical changes they documented are so specific. Like, they didn't just say, oh, the brain got bigger. They pinpointed three distinct architectural upgrades.
Right. Three specific changes.
The first one was a massive increase in the density of dendritic spines. Now, for the listener who might need a quick anatomy refresher, these spines are these incredibly tiny protrusions that pop out of the main branch of a neuron.
Yes, they are the actual physical docking stations where synapses form.
So if a neuron is a tree, the spines are the tiny twigs where the leaves connect, right?
Precisely. The spine is where the biochemical handshake between two neurons actually happens. So a higher density of spines means a greater capacity for communication across the whole network.
Okay, so that was the first thing, spines. The second thing they saw was the growth of new neurites.
Right, the branches themselves.
Yeah, so not just adding twigs to existing branches, but the neuron was literally extending brand new branches out into the surrounding tissue.
Extending its reach.
And then third, they measured strengthened synaptic connections overall. So the communication across these new pathways wasn't weak, it was robust.
And we really need to emphasize the timeline here, because this is where traditional psychiatry gets turned completely on its head.
Yeah, the speed is crazy.
Right. When we talk about neuroplasticity in the context of, say, learning a new language or going to standard therapy,
it takes months or years.
Yes, it's a glacial process of slow, repetitive conditioning. But in the Lai and Olson study, they saw visible structural change within 24 hours.
A single dose produced a visible hardware upgrade the very next day.
Exactly.
Okay, this is where I have to push back a little, or at least play the skeptic for a second. Because reading through the methodology in the source material, it mentions they were looking at rodent neurons, which, sure, I expect that.
Standard preliminary research.
But it also mentions fly neurons, fruit flies. Now, I know science starts small, but a fruit fly's neural network is radically different from the human cerebral cortex.
It is, definitely.
Like, a fly isn't ruminating on its childhood trauma, you know. How can scientists legitimately jump from a fruit fly in a petri dish, sprouting a new branch, to treating human clinical depression?
It's a completely valid skepticism. On the surface, jumping from a fruit fly to human psychiatry seems, well, absurd.
Right.
But in evolutionary biology, it actually points to something incredibly profound. It's a concept known as deep evolutionary conservation.
Conservation, meaning the biology is conserved or kept across the evolutionary timeline.
Exactly. When you see a biological mechanism operating in a human, and you find that exact same mechanism in a rodent, and then you find it in an invertebrate like a fruit fly.
You have to look at the family tree.
Right. Humans and flies diverged from a common ancestor hundreds of millions of years ago. If a specific cellular pathway has survived that immense span of time without being discarded by natural selection, it tells us something vital.
It tells us it's important.
Very. It tells us this mechanism isn't some complex, fragile quirk of human psychology. It is a deeply ingrained, foundational biological blueprint for cellular survival.
So, because it's so old and universal, it's essentially the base code for how living tissue adapts.
That's it. It transcends species. The cellular machinery that allows a neuron to reach out and connect to another neuron is so essential to life that evolution locked it in early.
Wow, okay.
So when Lai and Olson show that these molecules can trigger this foundational growth switch in a fly, a rat, and a pig, it provides enormous confidence that they are tapping into a universal mechanism, one that will absolutely apply to human neural architecture.
That makes perfect sense. It's like finding a line of machine code that executes perfectly on a massive cloud server, but also runs on a digital watch from the 1980s.
Exactly. You know you've hit the bedrock of the operating system.
But let's bring this bedrock mechanism back to the human walking around in the world. Let's talk about the why.
The clinical application.
Yeah. Why does growing new branches on a neuron actually matter to someone suffering from mental illness? Sprouting a new twig sounds cool in a lab, but what does it do for my mood?
It's a crucial question.
The article bridges this gap by exploring the atrophy hypothesis of depression. And I think this is where the paradigm shift hits hardest.
The atrophy hypothesis is absolutely critical to this whole conversation. For a very long time, the public narrative, and frankly, much of the psychiatric narrative around depression, has been dominated by the chemical imbalance theory.
Right. The idea that you just don't have enough serotonin floating around in the brain so you feel depressed.
The classic SSRI explanation. Take a pill, boost the serotonin, fix the mood.
Right.
But over the last two decades, as imaging technology improved, we began looking closer at the physical brains of individuals with severe chronic stress and depression. And a much darker physical reality emerged.
The atrophy.
Yes. The atrophy hypothesis suggests that depression is not just a transient chemical deficit. It is a structural disease. Chronic stress actually causes the physical retraction of dendrites and the literal death of synapses in highly specific brain regions.
The source material highlights the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus specifically, right?
Yes. And those regions are vital. The prefrontal cortex is your executive center. It handles complex decision-making, cognitive flexibility, top-down regulation of your emotional responses.
And the hippocampus.
The hippocampus is the seat of memory and learning, and it provides context for your experiences.
So what exactly is the stress doing to them? Why do they just wither away?
Well, when an organism is subjected to chronic, inescapable stress, whether that's trauma, chronic anxiety, or severe depression, the body's fight-or-flight system is constantly engaged.
So you're just flooded with cortisol.
Exactly. You have a constant wash of stress hormones flooding the brain.
Yeah.
And the hippocampus is absolutely packed with receptors for cortisol.
Oh, wow.
So over time, that constant toxic bath of stress hormones forces the neurons into a defensive posture. To protect themselves from overstimulation and excitotoxicity, they literally pull their branches back.
They dismantle their own spine.
They shrink. The architecture of mood regulation and cognitive flexibility physically withers away.
Man, so when someone with severe depression describes feeling stuck, which, I mean, that's the word you hear constantly, right? I feel stuck.
Yes, constantly.
They feel trapped in this loop of negative rumination, unable to see alternative perspectives. That psychological rigidity is actually mirroring a physical rigidity.
Exactly.
The brain has withdrawn into itself. It has dismantled the physical bridges that would allow a thought to travel down a new, healthier pathway.
That is exactly it. The psychological inability to change is a direct manifestation of a biological inability to change. The connections simply aren't there anymore.
Which is devastating, but it also explains why this research is so important.
Right. This is why the Lai and Olson study comes crashing into modern psychiatry like a lightning bolt. Because if the root cause of the pathology is withered branches and lost connections, then the holy grail of treatment isn't just tweaking ambient serotonin levels.
The holy grail is rapidly regrowing those branches. And that is exactly what the research shows these psychoplastogens do. Within a day of a single dose, those withered, retracted branches in the prefrontal cortex begin to bud again.
The structural integrity is restored.
It's not just masking a symptom, it's literally repairing the cellular damage caused by trauma.
Which completely reframes the timeline of healing. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the OOTW piece discusses this concept of the afterglow window.
Right, the afterglow.
Have you ever spoken to someone a few days after a profound psychedelic experience or even like a successful ketamine infusion?
Yeah, they often describe feeling much lighter, more open, like the volume of their inner critic just got turned way down.
Exactly. So from a neurobiological perspective, what is happening during that afterglow is that the brain is suddenly flush with these brand new, raw, highly malleable synaptic connections.
The psychoplastogen forced the growth.
Right. But, and this is a really critical point, those new connections are naive. They haven't been programmed yet. They create the capacity for change. But the afterglow window is a highly sensitive period.
Because new experiences have to shape it.
Right. Therapy, conscious behavioral changes, those are what sculpt that freshly grown circuitry. You've rebuilt the bridge out of the rut, but you still have to actively choose to walk across it.
That is an incredibly hopeful biological reality for anyone listening who feels stuck. But it inevitably leads us to the next massive question.
The how.
Exactly. We know what happens, the structural repair. We know why it matters, reversing the physical atrophy. But how? How does a chemical trigger a biological construction crew?
It's not magic. It's biochemistry.
Right. And the text walks us meticulously through this molecular engine. Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because we need to trace the exact biochemical chain reaction.
And it is an incredibly elegant engine. At the center of all this structural repair is a master protein called BDNF.
Which stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor. The article calls BDNF the brain's fertilizer, which is just such a helpful visual.
It's the perfect visual. Oh. BDNF is an endogenous protein, meaning your brain produces it naturally. Mm. Its primary job is to tell neurons to survive, to grow, and to differentiate. Mm. Like, whenever you learn a new skill, your brain releases small amounts of BDNF to help wire that new memory.
But these psychoplastogens do it on a massive scale.
Right. They trigger a massive, localized flood of this fertilizer. Without BDNF, the entire plasticity process just halts.
Okay, let's build a gardening analogy together to visualize this whole pathway.
Sounds good.
Because understanding this pathway is the key to everything that comes later in the deep dive. So the whole process kicks off at a very specific docking station on the outside of the neuron called the 5-HT2A receptor.
The classic serotonin receptor that psychedelics are famous for binding to.
Right. So the psychedelic molecule crosses the blood-brain barrier, finds that 5-HT2A receptor, and binds to it.
Changing the receptor's physical shape.
Okay, so in our garden, the 5-HT2A receptor is the main water valve. The psychedelic molecule is the hand that turns the valve wide open. What happens next?
Well, turning the valve on forces the neuron to release its stores of BDNF into the extracellular space.
It releases the fertilizer.
Exactly. But now that the fertilizer is out there, it has to be absorbed to actually do its job.
Yeah.
Right? It binds to its own highly specific receptor on the neuron's surface, which is called TRKB.
TRKB, spelled TRKB. So TRKB is the root system of our plant.
I like that, yes.
The water valve, 5-HT2A, releases the liquid fertilizer, BDNF, which gets soaked up by the roots, TRKB.
And once those roots absorb the BDNF, they send a powerful chemical signal deep into the interior of the cell.
To wake up the master controller.
Right, a controller called MTO.
MTOR. It sounds like a villain from a sci-fi movie.
It really does. It stands for the mammalian target of rapamycin. But MTOR is essentially the general contractor of the cell.
Okay.
It regulates cell growth, protein synthesis, and survival. When MTOR gets the signal from TRKB, it kicks the cellular factories into overdrive. It takes raw materials and begins aggressively synthesizing the specific proteins needed to build those new dendritic spines and branches.
So MTOR is the cellular factory churning out the new leaves and branches. Let's just recap that flow for a second. You turn on the valve, 5-HT2A, which releases the fertilizer, BDNF.
Right.
Which is absorbed by the roots, TRKB, which turns on the factory, MTOR, resulting in explosive new growth, valve to fertilizer to roots to factory.
It's a beautifully orchestrated cascade. And what makes this scientific narrative so ironclad is not just that researchers observed this chain of events, but how they proved it was necessary.
Oh, right. The blockade studies.
Yes. In pharmacology, demonstrating that A leads to B is a good start. But the gold standard for proving a mechanism is a blockade study. You have to prove that if you systematically remove one specific piece of the machinery, the entire outcome vanishes.
So they systematically sabotaged the garden to prove how it grew.
Precisely. First, the researchers administered the plasticity-promoting drug, but simultaneously applied a chemical agent that neutralized BDNF.
They took away the fertilizer.
And the result?
Yeah.
The plasticity completely collapsed. The drug lost all its power to grow neurons. So they proved the fertilizer was strictly necessary.
Wow.
Then they ran the experiment again, this time allowing the BDNF to flow, but chemically blocking the TRKB receptor.
Clogging the roots. Let me guess. Zero growth.
Zero growth. The architecture remained completely stagnant, Finally, they allowed the entire top half of the cascade to happen, but they introduced a compound called rapamycin, which specifically inhibits MTOR.
They shut down the factory.
And again, the rewiring failed to happen. By systematically blocking the hose at every single junction, they proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that this specific pathway, the BDNF-TRKB MTOR engine, is the absolute non-negotiable mechanism for this rapid structural repair.
And understanding that engine unlocks a major mystery in psychiatry, actually, specifically regarding ketamine.
Yes, the ketamine connection is huge here.
The text brings this up, and it's fascinating because ketamine doesn't look or act like a classic psychedelic. It doesn't bind to the 5-HT2A serotonin valve at all.
Not at all.
It works on an entirely different system, the glutamate system, acting as an NMDA receptor antagonist. Yet, ketamine is famously used in clinics right now as a rapid-acting antidepressant. How can a completely different chemical achieve the same rapid healing?
That was a massive puzzle for years.
Mm-hmm.
But once the MTOR pathway was illuminated, the pieces just fell into place. The source material notes that while ketamine enters the cell through a completely different biochemical door, the glutamate system rather than the serotonin system, its downstream effects converge on this exact same BDNF-TRKB-MTOR pathway.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, ketamine effectively bypasses the 5-HT2A valve, but it still triggers the release of the BDNF fertilizer, which hits the roots, which turns on the MTOR factory.
So even though they have completely different starting lines, they cross the exact same biological finish line.
Exactly. And this realization caused a massive tectonic shift in how scientists classify these drugs.
Because they needed a new way to group them.
Right. You have classic psychedelics like LSD and psilocybin. You have atypical dissociatives like ketamine. You even have empathogens like MDMA.
Chemically, they are wildly diverse.
Very. And subjectively, they produce radically different human experiences. But functionally, biologically, they all utilize this exact same molecular machinery to regrow neural architecture.
Which brings us to a pivotal moment in 2018, because scientists realized they needed a new word. Our existing vocabulary, hallucinogens, dissociatives, stimulants, was based entirely on subjective effects.
Or acute behavioral effects, yes.
But now they had this group of diverse molecules united by a profound, hidden, structural superpower. So David Olson, the researcher behind the Cell Report study, coined a brand new term.
Psychoplastogen.
Psychoplastogen. It's an incredibly powerful piece of scientific nomenclature. The text defines a psychoplastogen as any compound that produces rapid, robust promotion of neuroplasticity, specifically structural plasticity, after a single exposure.
It's a brilliantly engineered term. Psyche for mind, plast for molding or changing, and gen for generating.
Mind molding generators.
And notice what is entirely absent from that definition. There is no mention of hallucination, no mention of serotonin or glutamate, no mention of a mystical experience.
Right.
The definition is a broad tent that unites these compounds strictly based on what they do to the physical neurons, entirely divorcing a classification from how they make a person feel.
Okay, but as someone trying to understand the clinical reality of this, I have to play devil's advocate here. Because grouping MDMA, ketamine, and LSD into a single category called psychoplastogens feels, well, a bit reductive, maybe even dangerous from a clinical perspective.
This raises an important question, certainly.
Because if you talk to anyone who has experienced these compounds, they will tell you they are worlds apart. Ketamine can feel cold, dissociative, like you are detached from your body. MDMA is famously heart-opening. It floods you with empathy. LSD is intensely visual.
They are drastically different phenomenologically.
So if the human lived experiences are so radically different, isn't it muddying the waters to lump them all together just because the end result under an electron microscope looks the same?
It's a crucial point of tension. And it is the exact debate defining the vanguard of the field right now. If you are a therapist sitting in a room with a patient, the subjective differences between MDMA and ketamine matter immensely.
Of course they do.
They dictate the entirely different psychological journeys the patient will go on. However, from a purely biochemical and pharmaceutical development standpoint, Olson's reframing is strategically brilliant.
Brilliant. How so?
Because for decades, the driving scientific question in the psychedelic space was, how do trips heal?
Right.
That is a philosophical question. It's deeply qualitative. It involves consciousness,
yeah.
Meaning-making, narrative. It is virtually impossible to design a clean, objective clinical trial or engineer a new pharmaceutical based on the metric of a profound trip.
It's too messy.
Way too messy. But by coining the term psychoplastogen and focusing exclusively on the cellular mechanism, Olson shifted the paradigm. The new driving question of the field became, how do we safely maximize plasticity?
Ah, I see. It takes the mystery out of the realm of philosophy and drops it squarely onto the workbench of measurable biochemistry. How do we maximize plasticity is a question a medicinal chemist can actually answer.
Precisely. It is sharp, it is measurable, and most importantly, it is druggable. You can run thousands of compounds through cellular assays, completely ignoring whether they cause hallucinations in mice, and simply measure, does this turn on the MTOR factory? Does this grow spines?
Wow. And the moment you change the goalpost from inducing a meaningful trip to maximizing structural plasticity, you invite the most provocative multi-billion-dollar question in the entire field.
The ultimate frontier.
The text confronts this head-on. If the true healing mechanism is the molecular plasticity, and the plasticity is just a biochemical cascade, do you actually need the subjective hallucination at all?
That is the question. Can we decouple the neuroplasticity from the profound, demanding, and sometimes terrifying hallucinogenic experience? If the trip is just the noise the engine makes while it's running, can we build a muffler?
And that leads us to the Tabernanthalog breakthrough, the quest for healing without the trip. The OOTW Journal article highlights an absolute blockbuster paper published in the journal Nature in 2020.
From David Olson's lab.
Yes, authored by Cameron and colleagues. And the story of how they engineered this molecule is fascinating. They didn't just build it from scratch, they started with an incredibly complex, naturally occurring molecule called ibogaine.
Ibogaine is one of the most fascinating compounds on Earth, really. It's derived from the root bark of the iboga shrub, found primarily in central West Africa, where it has been used for centuries by the Bute religion in initiation ceremonies.
And in Western clinical contexts, it's famous, or perhaps infamous, for its ability to interrupt severe substance use disorders, particularly opiate addiction.
Yes. Anecdotally, and in observational studies, people with severe heroin or fentanyl addictions will take ibogaine and report not only a massive reduction in cravings, but an almost complete cessation of the agonizing physical withdrawal symptoms.
Which is a miracle for someone in withdrawal. But clinically, ibogaine is a nightmare to administer safely.
It is a nightmare because
Right.
of the toxicity.
Right. The text mentions it is heavily cardiotoxic.
Highly cardiotoxic. It interacts with specific channels in the heart HERG channels, which can lead to fatal cardiac arrhythmias.
So you could literally have a heart attack.
Yes. And on top of that, the subjective experience is grueling. An ibogaine trip can last for 24 to 36 hours.
36 hours.
Yes. It is intensely visionary, often described not as a euphoric trip, but as a punishing rapid-fire review of every mistake and trauma in your life. You need intensive medical monitoring and EKG, days of recovery. It is a profoundly difficult intervention to scale.
So Olson's lab looked at ibogaine and realized they had a molecule with unbelievable plasticity-promoting and anti-addictive properties, but it was trapped inside a highly toxic, hallucinogenic shell. So they brought out the chemical scalpels. The text describes how they systematically began stripping the ibogaine molecule down, cutting away structural components to see what they could remove while still keeping the BDNF engine running.
It's an incredible feat of medicinal chemistry, really. They wanted to engineer a structural cousin, an analog, that preserved the therapeutic core but deleted the toxicity and the hallucinations.
And what they ended up with is a novel molecule they called tabernanthalog, or TBG for short. And the results published in Nature are nothing short of staggering.
They are.
The text details the animal trials. First, they proved TBG is non-cardiotoxic. It doesn't disrupt the heart rhythm.
Huge hurdle cleared.
Second, they use standard behavioral assays in mice, like the head twitch response, which is a reliable proxy for hallucinogenic activity. The mice given TBG showed no signs of hallucinating.
So they successfully stripped away the danger and the trip. But the critical question remained, did it still work?
And the answer was yes. Under the microscope, TBG successfully promoted robust structural neuroplasticity. It grew the new dendritic spines, it extended the neurites, the MTOR factory fired up perfectly.
And more importantly, this microscopic growth translated into massive behavioral shifts in the animals.
Right. The text states that in animal models, TBG significantly reduced alcohol-seeking behavior, it reduced heroin-seeking behavior, and it produced strong antidepressant-like effects in forced swim tests.
In other words, they achieved the Holy Grail. They kept the physical rewiring, they kept the therapeutic behavioral outcomes, and they completely removed the subjective trip.
They successfully divorced the molecular healing from the conscious experience.
The implications of this for modern healthcare simply cannot be overstated.
I really want to paint a picture for the listener of what this means practically, because it changes everything about how mental health could be treated in the future. Right now, if you want the structural brain repair offered by a psychedelic, you are looking at a massive, resource-intensive undertaking.
Very resource-intensive.
You have to find a specialized clinic. You undergo weeks of psychological preparation. Then you come in and take a substance that induces a profoundly altered, highly vulnerable state of consciousness for 6 to 8 hours.
You require 2 trained facilitators sitting in the room with you the entire time to ensure you don't panic or harm yourself.
And there is always the inherent risk of a bad trip, a terrifying psychological ordeal. Because of this, classic psychedelic therapy is incredibly expensive, difficult to scale, and entirely unsuitable for large swaths of the population.
Right, like individuals with a personal or family history of schizophrenia or severe bipolar disorder. It's a boutique medical intervention. It simply cannot serve the hundreds of millions of people worldwide suffering from depression and addiction.
But TBG represents a completely different paradigm. It is a take-home pill.
Yeah.
You wake up. You take your TBG pill with your morning coffee, you drive to work, you answer emails, you don't see geometric patterns on the walls, you don't confront the manifestation of your childhood trauma. But beneath the surface, silently, your brain undergoes the exact same structural hardware repair.
Your prefrontal cortex regrows its withered branches.
It democratizes access in a way the clinical model never could.
It circumvents the need for specialized therapeutic infrastructure. It bypasses the psychological risks that disqualify vulnerable patients. It transitions these compounds from intensive psychiatric procedures into standardized, scalable pharmaceutical prescriptions.
You take the pill, you get the neuroplasticity, you heal.
It is the ultimate dream for the pharmaceutical industry. A clean, biological cure for the hardware of depression without requiring the patient to do the agonizing, messy psychological work of a deep dive into their own psyche.
And there is a massive but here. Before we get entirely swept away by the promise of a take-home magic plasticity pill, the OOTW Journal article does a vital job of grounding us in scientific reality.
And it is essential we address them, because the hype surrounding psychoplastogens often drastically outpaces the current limitations of our data.
Because science is never a clean upward trajectory of pure progress. There are always limits, unknowns, and fierce controversies.
Exactly. The source material presents several major caveats, the first of which involves the actual models we're using to generate all this excitement.
Right. Caveat one, the models. It is so important to remember that almost all of the incredible structural evidence we've been discussing today, the time-lapse videos of new spines growing, the elegant blockade of the BDNF pathway, the behavioral shifts in addiction, virtually all of it comes from animal models and cultured neurons in petri dishes.
We are extrapolating from the mouse, the rat, and the fly to the living, breathing human being.
And while the evolutionary conservation we discussed earlier gives us a strong theoretical foundation,
it is not absolute definitive proof that identical microscopic processes are occurring in living human brains at the exact same magnitude.
The text explicitly points out that measuring real-time synapse growth in a living human brain is currently technologically impossible.
It is. We cannot simply slice open a living patient's skull, extract a piece of their prefrontal cortex, and place it under an electron microscope 24 hours after they take TBG.
That would be bad.
Very bad. I mean, we have functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, which allows us to see broad changes in blood flow and network connectivity that align with the animal data. We can see regions of the brain communicating more fluidly.
But that definitive microscopic structural proof counting the actual dendritic spines remains fundamentally locked behind animal models at this stage.
So we have to temper our excitement with a necessary dose of scientific humility.
Which brings us to caveat two, and I think this is arguably the most important concept for the listener to internalize today. Caveat two, context is king. The text makes a very firm, explicit point. Neuroplasticity is not automatically a good thing.
This is perhaps the most dangerous misunderstanding in the public conversation right now. People hear the word neuroplasticity, and they immediately equate it with healing or improvement.
But it's not.
No. Neuroplasticity is a strictly value-neutral biological state. It is neither good nor bad. It simply means a heightened capacity for change. The brain becomes incredibly malleable.
I love the analogy of wet clay. Psychoplastogens turn your rigid, fired clay brain back into wet, moldable clay. But wet clay doesn't inherently become a beautiful vase.
It could be sculpted into a masterpiece, or it can be smashed flat with a hammer.
Exactly. The biological capacity for change does not dictate the direction of that change. The new wiring still has to be shaped by experience.
Precisely. And this is why the text emphasizes that this newly generated wiring must be shaped by a healthy context. In traditional psychedelic therapy, this is why the integration phase is considered the most important part of the treatment.
The integration phase.
Yes. The drug provides the plasticity, the wet clay, but the subsequent weeks of therapy, journaling, and behavioral modification are the hands actually sculpting that clay into a healthier configuration.
Which begs an enormous question regarding the non-hallucinogenic take-home pill like TBG. If a patient takes a TBG pill, becomes highly neuroplastic, and then just sits on the couch, watches depressing news, and stews in their normal anxieties,
yeah,
will they actually get better?
Or does the absence of the profound subjective experience leave the clay without a sculptor?
Wow. And you have just articulated the root of the great controversy currently fracturing the scientific and clinical community. Can you truly decouple the molecular plasticity from the psychological context and the subjective experience?
Let's look closely at the two sides of this fierce debate.
Okay, on one side, we have what we can call the molecular camp. These are often the medicinal chemists and pharmacologists.
Yes. From their viewpoint, the molecular plasticity itself is the medicine. They argue that the hallucinogenic trip, the visions, the emotional catharsis, the spiritual revelations, is essentially an evolutionary accident.
An accident?
A biological byproduct, a side effect of hitting the 5-HT2A receptor too hard. It might be subjectively fascinating, it might feel deeply meaningful to the patient, but the heavy lifting of curing the depression is being done quietly in the background by the BDNF TRKB-MTR engine regrowing the physical branches.
So if you can trigger that engine without the trip, you get the cure without the side effect.
Right. It's a very mechanical, fundamentally biological view of human consciousness and mental health. Fix the hardware, and the software will naturally correct itself.
But on the other side of the debate, we have the experiential camp. These are often the clinical psychologists, therapists, and psychiatrists who actually sit with patients during these treatments.
And they vehemently insist that the meaning, the narrative shifts, the emotional breakthroughs, and the mystical sense of the felt experience are doing essential, irreplaceable therapeutic work.
They argued that depression isn't just a biological hardware failure. It is a crisis of meaning. It's a crisis of narrative, of deeply buried trauma, of a fractured relationship with the self.
And a non-hallucinogenic pill, no matter how much it fires up the MTR factory, cannot provide insight. A pill cannot grant you self-forgiveness. A pill cannot help you confront and process a repressed memory of childhood abuse.
The experiential camp argues that the molecular plasticity simply opens the window, but the profound subjective trip is the mechanism that actually pushes the patient through that window to the other side.
They believe that stripping away the subjective experience strips away the very soul of the healing process.
It really is the ultimate showdown between biology and psychology. Is human consciousness just the localized byproduct of a well-wired motherboard? Or is consciousness, meaning, and narrative actively required to heal the motherboard when it breaks?
And the honest answer, as the source material readily admits, is that we simply don't know yet. The clinical trials comparing non-hallucinogenic psychoplastogens to classic psychedelics in humans are going to be the most important psychiatric experiments of the next decade.
They will redefine our understanding of the mind-brain connection. But while that philosophical debate rages on, we must not lose sight of what is firmly settled by the research we've discussed today.
Right. There are settled facts here.
It is settled science that this class of molecules, the psychoplastogens, are among the most powerful catalysts for neural growth ever discovered. They operate through this incredibly elegant, conserved, BDNF molecular engine.
And understanding that structural engine is fundamentally rewriting the entire field of psychiatry from the synapse up.
It truly is a breathtaking scientific journey we've been on today. To recap the massive terrain we've covered, we started by looking at how psychiatry spent a century focused purely on what a trip feels like, only to pivot in the modern era to watching the brain physically upgrade its hardware under a microscope.
We explored the tragic physical reality of the atrophy hypothesis, how chronic stress literally prunes back the branches of our prefrontal cortex.
And how psychoplastogens act as a rapid-fire fertilizer to regrow those withered connections in just 24 hours. We traced the exact biochemical gardening system from the 5-HT2A water valve through the BDNF fertilizer down to the MTOR cellular factory.
And finally, we arrived at the astonishing frontier of tabernanthalog, the engineered molecule that promises the structural rewiring without the hallucinogenic trip, setting off the greatest debate in modern mental health care.
It is an immense amount of complex biology to process, but I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to ponder something that builds on the text but pushes the implications into a slightly more provocative territory.
We discussed how neuroplasticity requires a healthy context because the capacity for change is value neutral. The psychoplastogen makes the brain highly impressionable, like wet clay. But this implies a rather startling and somewhat unsettling possibility regarding these non-hallucinogenic pills.
What happens if the environment is toxic?
Exactly. Imagine a future where a patient is prescribed a daily TBG pill for depression. They take it, their brain becomes highly neuroplastic and malleable. But what if they remain trapped in a severely abusive relationship?
Oh, wow.
What if they go to a workplace characterized by extreme chronic psychological distress? If these molecules truly make the brain hyperreceptive to its environment, could taking a plasticity-promoting pill in a toxic environment accidentally cause the brain to hardwire that trauma even deeper into its architecture?
That is terrifying.
If we decouple the medicine from the therapeutic clinic, we lose control over the context. The ultimate question we have to face isn't just how to make the biological clay wet again. The much more dangerous question is who or what environment is going to sculpt it once it is.
Wow. That is a chilling but absolutely vital question to sit with as this technology rushes toward the market. The medicine grants you the malleability, but your environment, your relationships, and your daily habits are the sculptors. If you are going to use neurobiology to soften the clay of your own mind, you better make absolutely sure the hands touching it are kind. Thank you for joining us on this incredibly deep dive today. We've traversed from the abstract philosophy of consciousness down to the literal roots of cellular biology. It is a complex, rapidly evolving frontier, but beneath all the debates, it is fundamentally a story of profound hope, the biological proof that we are not permanently stuck and that our brains are remarkably built for physical renewal. Stay curious, keep questioning the nature of your own hardware, and keep learning. We will see you on the next deep dive.